Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second in our three-part series from Sacred to Senseless, unpacking and unraveling what exactly is going on when we talk about Minhagim. And what we focused on last week was fundamentally the recognition that the word Minhag, the word custom, is in many ways best understood as a homonym. There are actually many, many, many different things that we encounter in our Jewish lives, all of which can be described as Minhagim, but they all have varying levels of seriousness. They all have varying levels of correctness is the wrong word, but their compellingness is varied, right? Not all of them are as equally strong as others. And as I mentioned last week, we can think of almost six different categories of Minhag, plus the seventh, which is just those things you do. And we started exploring last week what those categories are. We also last week did look at some suggestions of what exactly motivates the power of Minhag. And this week and this year, we'll see some sources that kind of touch on that once again. But fundamentally, the first set of Minhagim we had looked at last week were what we called Minhagei Chumrah. And these are essentially stringencies, they are chumrot, right? What happens is, right, there is a certain fear from certain areas of halachic literature, and the fear is that people are going to violate certain prohibitions, and so a chumrah comes along, a stringency comes along to mitigate against the violation of that. And at the end of the day, it becomes a minhag, it becomes binding on a certain community to observe this chumrah to the point that, right, they have to take it seriously. The most famous example of a minhag chumrah is kitniot for Ashkenazim, right? Ashkenazim do not eat rice or legumes or other things on Pesach. We don't actually think it's chametz, but we treat it effectively as though it's chametz, and therefore we won't eat it. And this is very much it's a minhag, but it's serious halacha, right? I hate to sound so strident, but if there was someone's home and they were cooking rice on Pesach and they were Ashkenazim, if they were Sfardim, I wouldn't blink an eye. But if I learned they were Ashkenazim and they were cooking rice on Pesach, it would kind of worry me about what other things are going on, because ultimately we treat that as Ashkenazim as a fundamentally serious prohibition. However, it is still a minhag, right? It's not a minhag in the same way that it's your minhag to sing Chad Gadya to that funky tune, but it is nonetheless a minhag. And Ruthie, and I had just been talking about minhagim, based on the first shir, right? And the kind of the interesting point she made is this idea that we also saw last week at the end of the shir when it came to kitniot, that when you get married, if an Ashkenazi woman marries a Sephardi, she can adopt all of his minhagim, and therefore now it's perfectly acceptable for her to eat rice on Pesach. And how strange it sounds that someone just gets married and all of a sudden, boom, right, a new set of laws apply to them. And we had a broader discussion about this, but one of the things I mentioned is, and that is why the term minhag is so important to remember, because even though we take kitniot so seriously, right, it's not bona fide halacha in the same sense. And the fundamental difference is the mechanics of how it works, how we relate to it, how we decide certain scenarios and certain questions that relate fundamentally to the notion of minhag. It's very different to halacha. If there's a halacha, you can't do X, right? That's very different to there is a minhag, right? Even when we take that very seriously. So that was Minhagei Chumrah. And for people who've not yet had a chance to listen to the first shir, we talked about that in the kind of the final part of the shir. We talked about Minhagei Chumrah. What I want to talk about this evening are three other types of Minhagim that will close out what I will call kind of the super serious Minhagim, right? These are the Minhagim that, right, are very, very, they're not very, very, very different from one another. We're about to encounter a set of Minhagim, a type of Minhag that is related to Minhagei Chumrah. But fundamentally, all of these types of Minhag that we're about to discuss today are very serious, but as we're going to see from the sources, they are treated very differently than each other and then certain other things with halachic literature. And the first type of minhag I want to talk about today, as I share the source sheet right now, is what we call minhagei machloket. So again, I should stress, and I think this is important to once again stress at the beginning of this year, it is, think of the various categories of minhagim, not as a definitive list, but as a helpful heuristic, right? There's a lot of blurring between these various categories. The names aren't exactly the best names, and not everyone like agrees to these names. It's not like matzah is called matzah and no one disagrees, right? These kinds of things, it's much more fluid, but it's more, right? Our goal is not to be able to think of every single minhag we encounter in our lives and know exactly what box it's going to fit into. Rather, it's to have, again, this better understanding of these different notions of minhag, these different categories that all make up the word minhag, even though, again, they usually have a crucial second word, or they have a crucial defining, right, quality to them that makes them different from other minhagim. What are minhagei machloket? So minhagei machloket are, again, they are related to minhagei chumra. Right, that they have a certain similarity, but there is a core difference. When it came to minhagei chumra, right? Minhagei chumra are it's an avoidance of prohibition, right? We are afraid, Ashkenazim, that rice is contaminated, and so we are cautious. Sfardim, this is a vast overstatement, are not cautious. They are, but they're not as fundamentally concerned, and therefore they don't avoid rice. Right? But ultimately, the whole notion of the chumra comes along to protect a wider vow. Minhagei machloket are different. At the end of the day, halacha is pretty black and white. And there are plenty of situations in halacha where there is majority opinion, right? There is a certain level of consensus, but there are certain things where there just isn't, right? There are certain things that are fundamental debates, right? There are fundamental, right, rabbi A says X, Rabbi B says Y, and I'm saying, right, Rabbi A and B are equal, right? It's a Rambam versus Rashi debate, right? And there is no agreed, right? We definitely follow this opinion over this opinion, right? And we'll use the example soon. We're going to talk more about the theory, and then I'll get to kind of the most clear-cut concrete example of this. So if my explanation of trying to talk about it isn't the clearest right now, hopefully the sources will help. But ultimately, minhagei machloket come around to solve our quandary. If there are two opinions out there that are equally valid, and we don't know which one to follow, we have a minhag. We have a custom to follow a specific opinion, not rejecting the other opinion. Often in halacha, we follow Rambam over Rashi or Rashi over Rambam because we think one is more correct than the other for whatever reason. Or there's some consensus that developed. In this case, the minhag has just developed to follow one over the other. There is a fascinating example of this in the Gemara in Menachot. We don't need to get into the details, but it's talking, right, the chalitza ceremony. So fundamentally, right, within halacha, there is the concept of yibum, which is if a man dies childless, right, his brother marries the widow, in the widower instead, right, and the kind of the children become perpetuated through the husband who had passed away. Right, the alternative to yibum is chalitza, and it's this ceremony, and basically it involves a shoe. Right, the most important thing we need to know is chalitza is a ceremony that involves a shoe. I do remember, this is a complete sidebar, but when I was once in yeshiva in YU, and we were learning yevamot, and also that's where chalitza is also discussed, and I remember Rabbi Wida saying on the very first day, he was like, there are some people who, you know, suggest, why don't we go ask a Beit Din, can we go witness a chalitza? And he was like, why would we ever want to go and stare at this incredibly traumatic experience for this family and just like with our clipboards taking notes? Like, no, like we don't need to, right? There are some things we don't need to see live because they are happening at the same moment that other people are going through tremendous difficulties. So I can't really tell you that much more about what the ins and outs of chalitza are, but it involves footwear. And this is why this Gemara is crucial. Says the Gemara source number one, the following. Da amar rabba amar rav kahana amar rav. Im yavo Eliyahu, if Eliyahu comes, Eliyahu the prophet, he comes. Eliyahu is always understood in rabbinic literature as the great arbiter of all halachic debates, right? Eliyahu can come and always solve all halachic debates. He knows the true halachic position on things. Im yavo Eliyahu v'yomer cholzin b'man al. If he were to say you can do chalitza with a shoe, shom in lo, we would listen to him. Ein cholzin b'sandal, but if Eliyahu were to come and say you can't use a sandal for chalitza, ein shom in lo, we do not listen to him. Shekavan nahagu ha'am b'sandal, because the people have already accepted the practice, the minhag of using a sandal. In other words, right, this is a minhag machloket, right? There was a fundamental debate, even in the times of the Gemara, over whether or not you could use a sandal for chalitza, right? Don't ask me why, but that was the debate. There were good arguments on both sides. So the minhag, the custom, there was no true consensus, there was no true rule, but the minhag developed in order to say you can use a sandal. And the power of this Gemara is also, once you have a minhag to mediate a debate like that, you can't just reject it because of other halachic argumentation. So a minhag machloket comes along to establish a certain practice in an area where there is no clear and obvious position to follow or even consensus. There's just minhag. Before we get to the clearest example and a really fun shaila I once got, right, there's a couple of sources that speak to, right, the power and exactly what minhag machloka is. The first I want to look at is Rav Moshe Feinstein, who says the following. Minhag machloket, source number two, minhag de machloket bedin hu medine hora'ah. It emerges from the laws of hora'ah, of instruction. Right, hora'ah is, right, I tell you what to do. That's hora'ah. Right, de kodem se nifsaka halacha belishkat hagazit. Because before halacha had been decided in the Lishkat Hagazit, which was the place in the Beit HaMikdash where they kind of, it was the place of the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, where they decided things. Rashai kol chacham laharot kedaato, right? Every single wise person could just instruct people according to their own understanding. V'hashoalim otot tzurichim la'asot kamot, and people who asked them a question had to do what they did, bein l'kula bein l'chumra, right? Whether leniency, whether stringently, right? Before there was formal decided law, you would just ask a rabbi, right? A chacham, a wise person, would decide what to do based on their own intellectual capacity, and you would ask them what to do. And if they told you a stringent opinion, if you followed the stringent opinion. If they told you a lenient opinion, you followed that one. Right, and because, right, basically everyone in a certain area became this rabbi's, right, students, so they would ask them the questions, right? It basically became the law in the locale, right? You asked the sage, do we do X or do we do Y? And he said X, and because everyone was following that rabbi, that locale started to follow that viewpoint. Af ledorot acherim hadin kafishahora kol kafishahora, and that would just follow for in perpetuity. Kol zaman shelokam sham chacham hagadol mimenu b'chochma, right? But when a greater rabbi would emerge, right, they could then kind of override, right, what a previous rabbi had instituted, and people could follow that person instead. Ultimately, minhage machloket are, what do I do? Do I do X or do I do Y? Right. So usually, right, when people ask me a shaila, right, I am not using my powers of deduction. I'm not using my power of, Talmudic reasoning. Right? People ask me a question. I look it up, and if I've not already been taught the answer, I look it up in a book. Like my skill set as a rabbi is the ability to look things up in a book. Right? And so I can tell you the answer. Right, only oft often, right? Turns out answers are not all answers are in books. So then I call, right? Every I say like a rav, everyone has to have a rav. So I call my rebbe, right? My rebbe is a Rosh Hashiva, is a very very knowledgeable person. So right, he too will often go to his rebbe, right? It's a chain, but ultimately, right? Things eventually it comes to someone who has to make a decision on something that there's no explicit codified law, right? Minhage machloket. Are that dialed up to 10, and then you broke off the dial and it's stuck there, right? It is just right. We have decided, despite the fact that there's no clear, obvious answer one way or another, right? That is what we have done. But it emerges from that, from essentially a pure part of the halachic system, which is, right, what do I do? Right? It's really, really interesting because Rav Schechter talks about the popularity of the Mishnah Brura, right, the Chafetz Chaim's halachic work, in a very kind of similar language, of he argues why did the Mishnah Brura become the defining halachic work of the 20th century? Because most of the major rabbis of the 20th century were students of the Chafetz Chaim, and so it's natural that they all turned towards his work. For, you know, answers of how to do things and to follow things, and they espoused his view. Whereas Rav Schechter would point you have someone like Rav Soloveitchik, who did not come from Radin, where the Chafetz Chaim came from. He came from Volozhin, right? A completely different halachic world. And so Rav Soloveitchik didn't do, you know, half the stuff the Mishnah Berurah advocated for, because that wasn't the minhag in Volozhin, right? A great example is, right, the location of where you put on tefillin. The Mishnah Berurah says it's a whole thing. I don't want to get into why he says this, but the Mishnah Berurah says you should put on your tefillin outside of the room in which you're davening, and then you kind of enter the room with your tefillin already on, right? Which we actually see in BIV. There are sometimes people, there's a table outside the Beit Midrash, they'll put their tefillin on there and then they'll walk in. However, Rav Schechter points out that wasn't how they did things in Volozhin. Right, in Volozhin, they just put on their tefillin right where they sat, which is, you know, what a lot of people do. But fundamentally, right, the defaulting to the Mishnah Berurah emerged from the same mechanics from which Minhagei Machloket are also, in which Minhagei Machloket are already rooted, which is, right, you ask someone, right, and something is decided, or in this case, with the Minhagim, it's far broader. And it develops and creates its own perpetuating rule. Another source to this comes from the Pre-Chadash, right? Rav Chizkiya da Silva, a 17th century rabbi from Tuscany, a very, very, very important work of halacha. And in addressing this issue more broadly, he says the following: This all makes sense when you don't have a rabbi. Aval im yesh lahem chacham muvhak. However, if people have a specific, you know, rabbi they go to, yachol lahorot kula bedava shaharehim lo nahagu kein. Right? He can teach them to be lenient in certain things, even if they've not previously been lenient in that matter. Ela al pi oto posik la'asor kesovrim shadin kach. Even when there are other halachic authorities that say otherwise, v'kevan sheharav lo rayot l'sota divrei oto posik. And when the rabbi can kind of, you know, has positions, has arguments to, you know, oppose, right, previously held positions. And when the rabbi comes in and kind of contradicts the previous person, right, you can follow them. In other words, the power of the rabbi comes from his ability to suggest certain arguments one way or another, to convince people of the correctness of their opinions. That again is all within the rubric of minhage machloket. This is, I think, something actually that's very interesting and relevant, you know, at BIAV, because BIAV we have our book of minhagim, and that we seem to have copied and pasted from the Yom Gezel of Century City, because there are several places where it makes reference to the Yom Gezel of Century City. But there are certain things that are minhagim of BIEV, and then there are other things that are ostensibly practices instituted by either me or my predecessors, right? This always comes up. BIEV, the rule is we won't allow someone to be shaliach tzibor. We won't allow them to lead davening if they are wearing shorts. And someone once said to me that never used to be the rule, and then one of my predecessors instituted it. So, right, so the question is that a minhag? Or is that just kind of a ruling of a predecessor? If it's a minhag, our ability to override it is very unclear. But if it's a minhag, but it's really a decision of a predecessor, then there is what to say about kind of, you know, doing things differently. And so it's very important to understand these kinds of ideas. Similarly, Rav Shechter's definition of minhag fits probably best with minhage machloket, which is Rav Shechter believes, right, there is a classic idea that the notion of a minhag is, I do what I do because my father did it. And Rav Shechter doesn't think that's what a minhag is. He thinks a minhag is something if a father does something out of a principled halachic position, either they themselves, right, learned it or they were told to do it by a rabbi, that becomes a defining minhag. But if it's just something they did, it doesn't count. So the classic example he always uses is whether you stand for Kiddush, whether you sit for Kiddush, right? What exactly should you do? There's different opinions out there. So it could be that someone does something because they just do. Or they could do it because of a principled halachic position. Says Rav Shechter, it's only binding on their descendants if it's a principled halachic position, not if it's just something that they do. And I'll end this section with a fascinating shiloh that I received in my previous shul many years ago that relates to the most famous of the Minhage Machloket. The most famous of the Minhage Machloket is waiting between meat and dairy. Right, take a look at source number 4, the Gemara in Chulin, which says the following. Amar mar ugva, ana laha milta chala bar chamra lagabe abba. Compared to, it's a very kind of like a poetic phrase, but compared to my father, I am like vinegar and he is like wine. He's so much better than me. De ilu abba, because when it came to my father, he have a ochel basra ha'idna. When he would eat meat at this time, lo have a ochel gvina ad lemachar ad hashta. He would not eat dairy until 24 hours had elapsed. You know, he had meat at 12:30 in the afternoon. He wouldn't have cheese until 12:30 in the afternoon, the following day. V'ilu ana, but me, mar ugva, bahasa udata hu delo achilna. If I've had a meal in which I've eaten meat, I won't eat cheese at that meal. Lasuda acharita achilna. At the next meal, I will eat meat. I will eat dairy. Right? I don't want to get into the whole question over why we wait between meat and dairy. Right? It's a whole fundamental debate over what exactly are the motivations. But there are different minhagim, right? Different customs that people have as to how long they need to wait. The most famous is the Dutch community, which only wait 1 hour. There is a guy in Manchester who is of Dutch descent, so him and his family only wait 1 hour. There is 3 hours. And then there is, right, some definition of 6 hours, right? Different people have a different way of counting, right, the 6 hours, which is, we'll actually come to that because that was the shadow I once received. But also, right, in sources we see this in the Gemara, there's 24 hours. There's just your next meal, whenever that is. There's also 8 hours is suggested, right? This is the perfect example of there is no consensus, right? How do we decide the consensus? Minhag, right? A rabbi tells you to do X, or you grow up in a family that does Y, right? This is the minhag machloket par excellence. But I once received a fascinating shiloh in my previous shul. There was a family who had become observant through the Bostoner Rebbe. So they weren't pure Bostoner Hasidim, but they had a lot of the minhagim of Bostoner Hasidim. And Bostoner Hasidim wait a full 6 hours, right, between meat and dairy. So if you finish your meal, you finish eating meat at 12:30, you don't eat meat, you don't eat dairy until after 6:30. However, they had a son, and their son was in yeshiva in Israel in Ma'ale Adumim, at one of the yeshivot hezder. And in Ma'ale Adumim, they had meat for lunch, but then they would serve dairy a little after 5 hours had elapsed. Because the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, didn't believe you had to wait a strict 6 hours. He thought it meant into the sixth hour, right? Because again, it's all minhag. It's all a little bit fluid over how we count this time. So he didn't think it needs to be literally 6 hours, but it needs to be the sixth hour. You know, we're already into the sixth hour. And so their son came to me and is like, what do I do? Right? I want to eat, but they serve dairy at, dinner, and it's not yet been a full 6 hours. If I waited a full 6 hours, it'd be cold, it wouldn't be there anymore, other things are taking place, right? What do I do? Right? And I basically, right, eventually, right, the answer was, right, well, this is the perfect example of the minhag machloket. Right? Now, while you lived in your parents' home, right, you were following the minhag of the Bostoner Rebbe because, right, that's what they did. But now you're in yeshiva. Rav Nachum Rabinovich is your rav. You're making aliyah. You ain't going back to Boston, right? It's not so crazy to think that you can actually start, eating dairy after, into the 6th hour, following now the opinion of Rav Nachum Rabinovich, right? Minhage machloket, right? And this is what kind of a lot of these sources indicate, right? They can change. Right? It's not easy to change them. You can't decide to change them on a dime, right? You can't just decide tomorrow, I now want to wait 3 hours instead of six. It doesn't work like that. But there are certain situations, certain very real scenarios in which a minhag machloket can morph. It can change. So that's the second category of minhagim. Minhage machloket, similar to minhage chumrah, in one sense. Right, they emerge out of a halachic position taking within halachic literature, but they mediate a debate as opposed to the minhag chumrah, which take a staunch, right, take a specific stance on the debate. The next minhag I want to talk about, and this is maybe the most interesting, are minhagim that create a practice. This is something that prior to the minhag's creation was just not done, but when it becomes a minhag, it becomes set in stone. It's still technically a minhag, but I would wager all three of these examples are things that we do not even would never even think of using the term minhag for, right? Other than in its technical sense, right? These three examples all come from the Gemara. The first is the Gemara in Beitza, source 5. The most famous of all of them, v'hashta diyadinan b'kviya diyarcha. Right? Nowadays, right? So it's 2 days Yom Tov. Well, I don't want to go through the whole thing because it takes 10 minutes to properly explain. The simple explanation isn't perfect, but we'll roll with it for now. When you used to rely on human observation to know when the moon had fallen, had reappeared, sorry, you introduce error, you introduce time delays, you introduce a whole host of confusing things, which means you're never quite sure what day it is. You have a rough sense of when the moon's going to reappear, but basically every day exists in a Schrodinger's cat kind of state. Maybe it's this day, maybe it's the next day or the day before, whichever one it is, right? Hence 2 days Yom Tov, right? We're not sure if, right, the first day of Pesach, if the 15th of Nisan is going to fall this day or the following day, so we observe both, right? Rosh Hashanah is ubiquitously observed in the Orthodox world as 2 days, even in Israel, because the first day of the month is a problem for everyone. But otherwise, right, all the other Yamim Tovim in the middle of the month, it's not a problem for Israel, it's a problem for outside of Israel. So 2 days Yom Tov. Says the Gemara, nowadays we know how to calculate a calendar. We don't need to use human observation anymore. My timer avdinan trei yomi. So why are we still observing 2 days of the festivals in the diaspora? Mishum deshalchu mitam. They sent from Israel the answer. Hizaharu beminhag avotechem bideichem. Be careful to observe the customs of your ancestors that you received. Zimnin degazru hamalchut gezeira vaatei leikalkulei. Perhaps. Right, you'll live in not so good times and you'll lose your ability to calculate the calendar. Right, so just observe 2 days. Ultimately, the observance of 2 days Yom Tov is a minhag. However, right, it's a minhag again, very, very different to that tune you sing for Chag Gadya. But this minhag creates a practice, right? Without the minhag of 2 days, right, the minhag of 2 days Yom Tov is so powerful. It turns around and says, it's still Yom Tov today. No, it's not Chol HaMoed, right? You go to shul, you do all of your regular Yom Tov things. You daven all of your Yom Tov davenings, right? You do all of these various things the way you observe them, right? You make all of these brachot on things the way you're supposed to on a Yom Tov. That's the power of minhag. Of these kinds of minhagim, it literally creates a thing. Another famous example, very, very relevant to today, with today having been Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So what did we do this morning in shul? We said Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. And we began Hallel with the bracha on Hallel. Source number six, Rav Ikla LeBavel. Rav arrived in Bavel. Chazanhu de kakaru halela bereish yarcha. He saw that they were saying Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Svar la'af sokinhu. He thought to stop them. He thought they'd made a mistake. You're not supposed to say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Kevan dachaza dekam medalge daloge. When he saw that they were kind of skipping a few of the paragraphs of Hallel, Amar, he realized, Shmamina minhag avotehem bidehem, they must be maintaining a custom that they have received. The saying of Hallel on Rosh Chodesh is a minhag. The idea that we say Hallel is completely and utterly a minhag. There is a on Rosh Chodesh, right? On Sukkos, on the Yom Tov of Pesach, we say Hallel because we should. What motivated our saying of Hallel this morning on Rosh Chodesh? Minhag and minhag alone. We will come back to this idea because it's fascinating. I jumped the gun a few moments ago talking about brachot. And the final example, which is, I would say, the most anticlimactic, but it's also relevant. This actually, Gemara is talking more about the Beit HaMikdash, but still to this day, we remember it to a certain degree. The Gemara in Sukkah saw seven Itmar, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Right, there was a debate between Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. We're not sure which person said which, but Chad Amar Arava Yesod Nevi'im, Chad Amar Arava Minhag Nevi'im. The taking of the Arava, the willow, on the final day of Sukkot proper on Hoshana Rabbah. Right, there was a ceremony. Nowadays, we do something different on Hoshana Rabbah, but still fundamentally, we take the willows and the willows alone for part of it. Right, there is a debate whether it was a Yesod Nevi'im, whether the prophets instituted it, or whether it was simply a minhag nevi'im, whether it was a custom that the prophets instituted. But here too, we have a new practice. On the seventh day of Sukkot, you take your arava and you do stuff with it because the minhag creates the practice. Second day, Yom Tov, Hallel with a bracha, and arava on Sukkot are all minhagim. But they are all so powerful as to rewrite the way we do things. And what's so fascinating with all of these, other than, again, our power to remove them, our power to change things is practically zero in this regard, right? This also illustrates the power of minhag and potentially the limits of these minhagim too. Because if we take a look at sources 8 and 9, we see a fundamental debate about Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Rambam says the following, source 8. Kol davar shehu minhag, anything that is a custom. Af al pisha minhag nevi'im hu, even if it's a custom of the prophets, could go netilat arava b'shvi shel chag, such as taking the arava, the willow, on the seventh day of Sukkot. Ve'ein tzarich lomar minhag chachamim, and needless to say, a custom established by the sages, Kagon Kriyat Halal Barashecha Doshim Uvcholo Shalmoed Pesach, saying Halal on Rosh Chodesh or Cholomoed Pesach, Ein Mavarachin Alav. You do not make a bracha. Tosafot, on the other hand, source number 9, Uperish Bekuntras Rashi explanation de Nafgamina. There is an important practical difference between these two different opinions we saw about taking willow. De Itakanahi, if it was instituted, Baye bracha, it requires a bracha. Ve'i minhaga, but if it was a minhag, lo baya, it doesn't require a bracha. However, they then complicate this understanding that minhagim don't require brachot. Ve'yesh medaktikin mitoch kach de lo mavarachin a halal de rosh chodesh she'ina ala minhag ba'alma. Right, so first they say, right, there are people who want to prove from arava, right, you don't make brachot on any minhagim. However, v'rabbeinu tam omer, after the ellipses right here, Rabbeinu Tam Omer, the Ein Raya Me'arava LeHalel, right? There's no proof. We can't learn anything from the willow, from the taking of the willow to how we should practice Halel. The Arava Eino Ela Tiltul. At the end of the day, all you're doing with the willow is picking it up. You're moving it. V'kevan Delav Takanta Hi Ela Minhaga. And since it was just a Minhag, Lo Chashiva LeMikbe LeBracha, right? It's basically, it's not significant enough to require a bracha. Aval kriyat ha-halal lo gara mekora betorah. But like, halal is no worse than reading from the Torah where we make brachot. In other words, say the Baalei Tosfot, and this is actually in truth a very, very lengthy, long, long, long Tosfot where they explore this idea far more robustly, but minhagim do sometimes get brachot, right? If the action is significant enough, if there's such fundamental kind of follow through to the action, it does require a bracha. The arava doesn't because you're just waving around some willows. Halal is halal, right? That requires a bracha. And practically speaking, Ashkenazim, we said this morning in BIV, we said halal with a bracha. However, if we were a Sfardi shul, we would not. Sfardim don't say halal with a bracha on Rosh Chodesh, right? Interestingly, Chabad, I was actually looking into this and then a whole conversation with Rabbi Sassover about this because Chabad have a very interesting, complex, multifaceted opinion on this, but fundamentally, the question over whether you can make a bracha on a minhag, right, relates to the status and power of minhag. Ashkenazim, we think you can make a bracha, right? We use God's name and we say, Asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu. You commanded us to say halal on this minhag, and Sfarim don't. So in the whole discussion of whether or not you can make a bracha on halal, we start to see some really interesting positions emerge, again, on exactly how minhagim function. Now, again, we're about to see two sources which they have interesting reflections on minhag, right? They're not kind of fitting into the boxes we've been using, but it's still interesting to explore. The first is the view of the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda, the famed Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. First, he quotes the Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, which is grappling with another controversial bracha we make, right? My Mevarech, what do we say upon lighting our Hanukkah candles? Mevarech, asher kidshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu l'hadlik ner shel Hanukkah, right? Who has commanded us to light the flame of Hanukkah. God has commanded us in this rabbinic commandment. The Heichan Tzivanu, the Gemara asks, wait, what do you mean God commanded us? It's rabbinic. Rav Avya Amar. So Rav Avya suggests there is a verse that supports the rabbinic ability to institute these kinds of things. Milotasor, right? We saw this last week, right, in Sefer Devarim, right? Do not turn away from rabbinic instruction to the right or to the left. Rav Nechemia Amar, Rav Nechemia offers an alternative understanding. Sha'al Avicha v'yagedcha, ask your father and he will tell you. Zekeinacha v'yomru lach, and your elders, and they will tell you. Right? You know, basically, here Chazal are the elders, right? They can tell you to do things, essentially. That's also a verse from Sefer Devarim. So the Netziv builds on this, the following idea. Source number 11. L'Rav Nechemia. The Mevarachim be'ika the Rabbanan mishum mitzvat zekeinecha v'yomru lach. Rav Nechemia thinks, what gives the power to make brachot over rabbinic laws? Zekeinecha v'yomru lach. Ask your elders, the zekeinim, the elders, the sages, the rabbis, and they will tell you what to do. Hachanami al minhag denafgalan misha'al avicha v'yagedcha. Right, we can derive the same thing here. From sha'al avicha v'yagedcha, ask your father. In other words, what's the tradition here? And he will tell you, Hayinu minhag avotav, these are your ancestors' customs. So what legitimizes us making a bracha on halal? Minhag avoteam, it's our ancestors' practice and minhag. Sha'al avicha v'yagedcha, we ask them, what do? They said, do it. And therefore, right, that almost creates this quasi mitzvah that allows us to do these things. Minhagim can create practices that become set in stone, that become effectively, right, true halacha, except it's still minhag, but it's not minhag in the same way as some of these other minhagim, right? It's a fundamental thing, right? You can make halal on a bracha, you can make the bracha on halal on Rosh Chodesh, invoking God's name, claiming we've been commanded. Such is the power of these minhagim. The Chatam Sofer has a slightly different understanding of this whole question, which will kind of call back to certain ideas we've already seen. And he says the following. In my humble opinion, b'yishuv kasha zo devadai min haga b'shev v'al ta'asa la'asor davar Ma kagon shelo lalechet mitzor letzidan be'erev Shabbat. In my humble opinion, the answer to this question, right, it is recognizing the fact that minhagim are ultimately shave v'al ta'aseh, which literally means stop and don't do anything, right? And in this case, that could be prohibited, right? We've used the term minhagei chumrah. The Chatam Sofer is invoking that idea. Kagon shelo lalechet mitzor letzidan be'erev Shabbat. Don't go right from tzor to tzidon on erev Shabbat. We saw this example, don't do work on Erev Pesach, because our fear was you'll forget and you'll do the wrong thing. Uvi Yom Tov Sheni, right? Observing 2 days of Yom Tov. These are all to protect halachic values. He argues. Ha'ova al zeh, if you violate that, v'kam va'aseh ma'she ne'esar b'min haga, and you arise and do something that has been prohibited by force of custom, hareza over alav de divrei kabbalah al titosh torat imecha. You violate the prohibition, do not forsake the teaching of your mother, which we saw last week is often used as a source for minhagim. V'chein nami yom tov sheni, and similarly, right, we have ellipses, and then he's talking, and then he continues, right, regarding yom tov sheni. Sheha osa bo melacha minadin oto. If someone violates yom tov sheni, right, they reject the power of minhag, and so they don't treat Yom Tov Sheni like a real Yom Tov, right? There are, again, we're not talking about someone from Israel who's now in America. We're talking about like an American who lives in America, who lives in the Orthodox community, and they've decided it's all a minhag, I'm giving up on it, right? If they do that, you excommunicate them. Mishum she'over ahaniz kalamala, because they violated what he's mentioned before. Imkein, mimela mechayev midin gamor, gam b'chol ha'asin atluin bo, and therefore it's obvious that all of the associated obligations of Yom Tov Sheni and the like are dependent. Lahadlik ner, lighting candles, v'le'echol matzah u'maro, eating matzah and maro on Pesach, v'shayach v'tzivanu, you still say v'tzivanu, v'gam lomar et chag peloni hazere. On the final day of Yom Tov in America, right, on the 8th day of Pesach, calendrically it's no longer Pesach, and yet we can still get up in our davening and say chag ha'matzot hazeh, it's Pesach today, right? Kevan she minhagav mechuyavim ba medina, right? The minhag obligates you. So the Chatam Sofer has a slightly different idea here of the origin of these minhagim. But fundamentally, their power is insane. They can literally have us, right? If you, right, imagine if on the first night of Chol HaMoed, you're like, I'm going to have a Seder again. I'm going to have my third one. I loved the first two so much, right? That is a prohibition, right? You're not allowed to do mitzvot. You know, you can't eat maror, right? And believe you're fulfilling the obligation of maror on Seder, on a non-Seder night, right? That's a problem. But the minhag of Yom Tov Sheni is powerful enough to override that, right? Once the minhag is created, everything associated with it becomes relevant. Interestingly, in another teshuvah, which I don't have on the source sheet, right, and it's a whole question in of itself, but the Chatam Sofer argues, why can you make a bracha on Halal, on Rosh Chodesh? So Rosh Chodesh, he argues, and nowadays, and this is where we get into minhag inception, but nowadays the minhag is for women not to really observe this, but there is classically this idea that women don't perform melacha on Rosh Chodesh, right? They kind of treat Rosh Chodesh as a pseudo Yom Tov. And so again, says the Chatam Sofer, right, to protect Yom Tov, right, to protect Rosh Chodesh, sorry, you can make a bracha because, right, all of these various things, right, it fits with his general theory. But the point here that I just want to make before we turn to our final set of minhagim for today, minhagim that define a practice are technically minhagim, but in a league of their own, right? We don't really refer to them as minhagim except in the most technical sense, and they have the power to almost override what we would otherwise think is the default. And they are so powerful that to violate them is to violate halacha, right? There is, right, this is an exaggerated comment, but, right, fundamentally, right, cheeseburger and violating Yom Tov Sheni, right, are in the same halachic realm, right? They're in the same level of seriousness in ways that other types of minhagim are not, right? That is the power of these minhagim. But what is fascinating is, right, they just create a practice, which is fascinating. The final kind of minhagim that I want to talk about, and there is one fundamental and famous example of minhagim that define a practice. And these are the minhagim we interact with most frequently on a not just daily, but multiple times a day basis. A minhagim that define how we daven. Right? What is the nusach of our daven? The various traditions, the various kind of specific words and arrangements that we use, right? This is all mikoach minhag. Literally this past Shabbat, it was very convenient for this shiur, I realized, but it just happened organically, right? I had leaned at Shabbos Mincha, right? I was, you know, it was, you know, we kind of divvy up who leans at Shabbos Mincha, and it's either me or Rabbi Reuben. It's not really a divvying up. It's whoever doesn't say, I don't want to do it, has to do it. And Yaakov Cohen, had got Galila, and as I always do, as Hagbah is taking place, and then Galila is happening, I start saying, Mizmor Shir LeYom HaShabbat, because that's Minhag Anglia. That's the custom in England. It's probably a mistake. It's a whole interesting thing in and of itself. And Yaakov, who kind of picks up on these things, he's aware of these things, and he overheard me. I wasn't saying it loudly, but he just overheard me. He's like, wait, what? There was a little bit more to it than that, but fundamentally, I was like, yeah, that's Minhag Anglia, right? I have a bunch of practices I do because it is the Minhag of the English Jewish community to use certain words, right? There's a bunch of stuff I do for other reasons, but there are certain things I do, certain words I say, certain things I omit, certain things, right? There are certain things I, right, rarely say. In davening, than in America, you would say like every single day or every single Shabbat, because right, it's minhag Anglia not to. And what's really interesting about this is, right, for many years there was a fear minhag Anglia was going to be lost. Right, the customs of the English Jewish community were going to be lost, because for many years, right, this is a kind of a circa 1997 Siddur of Minhag Anglia. It's not actually that interesting for me to show up to the camera. It's not the worst Siddur in the world to use, but there was a problem, right? You know what's really, really good to use? Art Scroll, right? Art Scroll revolutionized the Siddur game. And so what basically happened was all the shuls in England were dropping their Minhag Anglia Siddurim in favor of Art Scroll Siddurim. The problem is Art Scroll Siddurim aren't Minhag Anglia. They are, right? It's a whole thing in and of itself, which maybe we'll have a chance to talk about briefly, but Art Scroll are their own, right? They reflect kind of American Minhagim. And so, over time, the erosion of Minhag Anglia was kind of happening. So they developed, in the 2000s, this very, very nice Siddur. It's with a commentary, right? My Siddur doesn't really have a commentary, right? And it's the commentary of Rabbi Sacks. And eventually this commentary would be picked up by Koren. But originally Rabbi Sacks wrote it for the Minhag Anglia Siddur, right? Which, you know, it literally says, people always find it amusing when they see it says like the authorized daily prayer, but this is the official, because it's Minhag Anglia, like it's literally the official, you know, customs of the English. It's not like that revolutionary compared to like other, you know, more exotic minhagim. But the point is, right, these are how minhagim work. They dictate how we daven, right? So in BIEV, right, David Sofer's Sfardi, Art School recently came out with a Sfardi Siddur and they sent it to me. I gave it to him because I didn't have a use for it, right? His Siddur is very different, right? We have Yankee Perlmutter who grew up in the Chabad world, right? His davening instincts are also different because of those nuscha'ot, right? So the minhagim that define a practice are the very way we daven things. And what I want to sketch out in the briefest of ways is exactly how this came to be. So if we take a look at source number 13, right? The Gemara in Masechet Brachot. Amar le Rav Shemen bar Abba le Rabbi Yochanan mikdei anshei Knesset HaGedola. Tignu lahem liYisrael brachot utfilot kedushot vahavdalot. Right, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the men of the Great Assembly, instituted for the Jewish people brachot tefilot, right, which more literally means the Amidah, kedushot vahavdalot, right, kiddushes or more broadly sanctifications and havdala nechse heichin takun. Let's see what they instituted when it came to havdala. Fine, but the point is here, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, right, are the originators of kind of forms of davening. And I didn't put any on the source sheet, but if you look in the Gemara in Brachot, you see certain tefillot take shape. However, at the same time, what must be recognized is, even in the times of Gemara, there were different communities. The Gemara in Megillah grapples with the correct Torah reading for Parashat Shkalim. And whether, right, we had this just a few weeks ago, and depending on which one you read, whether it's likely to just be naturally occurring during the Torah reading cycle anyway. Right, for our, the actual details don't matter. The crucial thing is going to be the final, like, point, which I'll double down on. But the Gemara says in Megillah, Bishleim elaman da'amar ki tisa hayinu demitrami bahahu zimna. If it's ki tisa, which is what our practice is, right, Parashat Shkalim, right, is going to coincide with Parashat ki tisa pretty often. You don't have to worry. Ela laman da'amar tzav et korbani, the people who say that you have this alternative Torah reading for Parashat Shkalim, Mimitrami Bahau Zimna. When on earth is that going to coincide? It just doesn't. In, yes, it does, Livne Ma'arva, Damaske La'oraita Blitshanin. No, there are people who, they observe a triennial cycle, the people of the West, the people in Israel. I'm going to end the source sheet, but I've still got a little bit more to say, but I just don't have any more sources for it. But what we see here in this Gemara is the recognition of two divergent customs. The customs of Israel and the customs of Babel. And what we start to see more and more is different communities developing the way they do their things. We enter the Gaonic period, and we have Rav Sadia Gaon and, right, others who attempt to, right, they create Sidurim for the first time. And, right, as Jews spread, right, and there's a fascinating article by Lauren Schiffman that I forgot to actually link on the source sheet, but right, and he talks about this in great length, and it's very, very interesting. Right, you start to have kind of five different nuscha'ot, five different liturgies that start to emerge in kind of the earliest forms of this, right? The definitive, this is how davening takes place. Right, you have what's called the names aren't necessarily so relevant, but Romaniot, which is the nusach of the Byzantine Empire, Greece, European Turkey, Roman or Italki in Italy, right? You have Spadi, which is the Iberian Peninsula and North Africa, right? Lots and lots and lots of local variants to that already at this point, but it can kind of all be grouped in one. You have the Rambam, which got adopted by the Yemenite community, where he basically took Sephardi liturgy and mixed it all in with his own specific halachic opinions on things. And you have kind of proto-Ashkenazi. So in, like, you know, Germany, France, England, Switzerland, Netherlands, Belgium, even parts of Italy, right, you have kind of this, like, you know, this kind of style of davening, which also starts to develop, right? In the 14th century, you have the Maharil, produces an Ashkenazi Siddur. Eventually, it splits into German and Polish, and then there's also Lithuanian versions. So, right, Slichot is a great example of this. There's, like, 13 different recensions? I don't know what the correct word is, but there's, like, 13 different versions of Slichot. And even, right, in the mornings, if you look in a Siddur, as we take out the Torah on a Monday and Thursday, right, there are two different versions of Kel Erech HaPayim. And it's because, right, it's two different minhagim from two different origins. And nowadays we just put them both in there, and right, because no one really knows which one they should be saying. That's kind of the first wave of the development of Nusra. The next big thing that happens is Lurianic Kabbalah, the Arizal. And Kabbalah, right, really, really takes off. Right, no liturgy really escaped it, which is why we do Kabbalat Shabbat, which is a Kabbalistic, right, thing. But basically you have a lot of these nuscha'ot start to splinter into Kabbalistic and non-Kabbalistic versions. So you have West Ashkenazi and East Ashkenazi, which are divided along Kabbalistic, non-Kabbalistic lines. Sfardim we always think of as the greatest embracers of Kabbalah, but the Spanish and Portuguese community. I have a very, very thin book by Rabbi Chaim Angel. Right, Rabbi Chaim Angel was for many years the leader of Congregation She'arith Israel, which is, right, the earliest shul in New York. It's Spanish and Portuguese to this day, right? And this book basically goes through, this is why we do things the way we do things. And like they just do things completely, the Spanish and Portuguese community do things completely differently, and they reject Kabbalah in one of the most extreme ways. Yemenites also, right? The Yemenite view that rejects Kabbalah actually thinks Kabbalah is heresy, which is fun. And then you have Nusach Ari, which was the Arizal's own Nusach. Eventually, Hasidim run with this idea, right? They don't actually completely adopt Nusach Ari. They kind of weave it into the Ashkenazi world. You have the creation of what's called Nusach Sfad, which some people argue is a pejorative term used. But fundamentally, right, you have all of these Nuscha'ot emerging. So nowadays you walk into a shul and it could be as simple as, right, the order of Psukei de Zimra or some of the words in their davening, or it could be what on earth is going on. So, right, for 3 years, I was the rabbi of a Nusach Sfad shul because the founders of the shul had originally come from the Hasidish world. And they weren't Hasidim themselves, but they'd come from a Hasidic community. Right, and it was different, but it was very similar to Ashkenaz in many ways. Whereas, you know, Ruthie grew up in Deal, which is, even though she grew up in the Ashkenazi community, it's a majority Syrian Jewish community. So if you ever catch Minyan there, sometimes you just find yourselves being like, am I still in a shul? Like, what on earth is going on? There are some things you've just never seen. They completely catch you by surprise, right? The minhagim that define a practice are all about the way we daven. And that is why sometimes, especially people who are ba'alei teshuva, they've grown to want to become observant, or people who go through the conversion process, right, finding a siddur actually becomes slightly more fraught and complicated because, hold on a second, you need to make sure the nusach that I've bought, I am ashamed to say I've now bought it twice. Two times the website has made the same mistake. I've given up now. I bought a siddur and twice it's come back nusach sfad. And it's like, I don't need that. I need the nusach Ashkenaz version. But fundamentally, right, minhagim define a practice. The most interesting example of this is the famous words of the art scroll siddur. Some say, some omit. Many say, many omit, right? We always ask, who are these? Who are the many? Who are the some? Right? What art scroll did when they wanted to create their siddur was they wanted to create a siddur everyone could use. So rather than publishing a siddur for specific Jewish communities, they collated all the things together. And they put them in there. And in theory, your community would know whether you say X or whether you don't say X. So again, Minhag Anglia, right? My siddur doesn't have certain things inside of it because you just don't say it. Whereas in art scroll, right? Sometimes it's in a smaller font, right? A great example of this is Anna Bechoach on Friday nights, right? It used to be a far more less sung thing on Friday nights during Kabbalat Shabbat. But nowadays, it's printed in all Siddurim in a slightly tinier font because they're trying to let you know not everyone is supposed to say this, but everyone says this, you know, nonetheless. These are the minhagim that define a practice. So what we've seen tonight are, in addition to the minhagi chumrah that we saw last week, minhagi machloket, minhagim customs that mediate, right, a halachic uncertainty, the best example being how long you wait between meat and dairy. We have minhagim that create a practice, and it's tremendously powerful when they do. Yom Tov Sheni, a bracha over Halal. And we've also talked in the briefest of ways, but there have been books literally written on this, right? Minhagim that have the power to define a practice. Why don't I say X? Or why do I say Y in my davening? Because minhag, the nusach of your siddur, emerges from the power of minhag, and that in and of itself defines the practice of its community. Next week, please God, we will take a look at two of the more interesting types of minhagim, which are basically the ones no one likes and the ones everyone disagrees with and the ones that are potentially deeply problematic. And then also, please God, discuss a couple of other really interesting issues that are adjacent to the area of minhagim, things that we tend to think of as givens because, oh, this is just true in the world of minhagim, and what we'll actually see is this might not actually be the case.